Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 25th of March, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's an absolute delight to have you here with us. And I think I speak for the entire group when I say it just feels better knowing that you're out there and you're listening and that you're being a part of the conversation. And we are thrilled to have you. So thank you very, very much for all you do. And we welcome you to join the conversation by simply writing to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I have a little experience in this. I don't know. I often get this wrong. I'm guessing we'll have a lot of letters today. I don't know. I'm guessing. So if you'd like to get yours in, keep them short and to the point, and we'll get to as many as we possibly can in the time we have allotted. I just want to, before we get into the topics and really the big topic of today, I want to mention the fact that we are going to be in Rhinecliff tomorrow. We are going to be broadcasting live from the Morton Memorial Library, and we could not be more thrilled about this. We're going out into our community, and we're going, this is the first in a long line of places that we'll be visiting over time, and bringing the show and shows to you and to communities in our listening area. And we're absolutely thrilled to start off. This is the first time we've ever brought a full roundtable panel on the road. So we're going to see how you all travel.
What a great idea.
We're going to see how you all do. Yeah, that's right. Wow. So we're going to be broadcasting live from the Morton Memorial Library. Now, I'll tell you right up front, tickets are gone. Tickets are sold out. So we had tickets and it's a fairly big room, and they're gone. However, we're going to broadcast it. So we hope that you'll listen to us tomorrow. It's going to be from 9 to 11. And here are our regular panelists, fellow panelists for you in this room. John Faso, Anna Markowitz, and Mark Whitman will all be on the show. And then we have looked for some of the best and the brightest within the Hudson Valley. And we've come up with this incredible group. Amitava Kumar, who's a best-selling author, journalist, and professor of English at Vassar College. Elizabeth Lesser, best-selling author and co-founder of Omega Institute in Rhinebeck. Danaw Mengestu, who is an author of three novels and is also a freelance journalist who has reported about life in Darfur, northern Uganda, and eastern Congo. Francine Prose, who is a best-selling author, memoirist, essayist, and critic, and just a badass. And Lucy Sant, who is an iconic writer whose latest book is a memoir about self-reflection and an exploration of the modern dynamics of gender and identity and about transition. And Lucy Sant will be with us as well. So it is a hell of a group, and we are very thrilled to have them all with us tomorrow. We do hope you'll listen and enjoy the program. After it airs, it will be available online, if you miss it, at WAMC.org, WAMC.org. And keep an eye out for future events where we go into your community and see what trouble we can get into there. All right. That is my announcement about that. Now, let me introduce our group, and we'll get started on the news of the day. I hope you are ready. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
I'm doing okay under the circumstances. You know?
Seems like you've had a little black cloud over your head.
A lot going on nationally and for me locally. So, yes.
Well, welcome. Very nice to have you with us.
Glad to be here. Looking forward to getting a lot of letters today. We want a lot of community input today.
We welcome editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer, and from the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, semi-retired, but here nonetheless. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I'm a little out of breath. I was on a text thread this morning that surprised the heck out of me. It looked like we were invading Greenland, but it turned out they were just looking for a restroom.
Yeah,
for the second lady. So you know, everything's under control.
It happens, and you just never know.
Yeah. You roll with it.
And our good
friend. You got your signals crossed?
Exactly.
Yes, the signals are crossed.
Yeah, hey, I was funny.
Yes, yes, Teresa, that was funny. And we go to our good friend JP Miller, who's in the house. Good morning, JP. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm great. And as my friends and family will tell you, I don't like being on text chains. No matter what they say, no matter what they are, I don't like being on text chains. I like one-on-one text communication.
Yeah, I don't. We've got a family one, and it's just like, oh, God.
You never know who's on there.
I have to like this.
You know, I like it. It's fun to know what the kids are up to, and then everybody, you know, there's like 9 people on ours, and then everybody kind of goes in, and then suddenly you have 10 messages, and you're looking through, and it's sometimes it's hard to keep track of.
I get so confused.
But can I just say? We're just talking about like what time the game starts, not war plans. Let's say. Okay, so let's get into it. This is a. I don't care. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. This is an incredible story. This is just an amazing, like.
Not in a good way. Incredible.
No, well, I mean, it's horrific, but it's just unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable, and here goes. So, Trump officials shared war planning in an unclassified chat with a journalist, and there are many facets to this that I think we can talk about this morning, and look at what. You know, what happened, what should happen, what should be the repercussions.
What should never happen.
Top officials in the Trump administration discussed highly sensitive military planning using an unclassified chat application, Signal, that mistakenly included a journalist, the White House acknowledged Monday, a development that swiftly drew criticism from Democrats and Washington's national security establishment. So, two things immediately going on here. One is an unclassified open app being used by the highest levels of national security officials to discuss war planning, number one. Number two, oh, and we added, accidentally, we assume, a reporter from The Atlantic by the name editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg. The inadvertent number belonged to Goldberg, whose article details a robust policy discussion that occurred in the lead-up to a March 15th military operation targeting Yemen's Houthi militants. Goldberg reported being added to the group chat, which occurred on the encrypted messaging platform Signal, by President Donald Trump's national security advisor, Michael Waltz. Other participants appeared to include Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, and several other aides, The Atlantic says, according, including Stephen Miller, who apparently just goes by the initials SM.
Of course he does.
Hughes, the National Security Council spokesman, characterized the discussion as, quote, a demonstration of the deep and thoughtful policy coordination between senior officials executing Trump's national security strategy. But the disclosure immediately raised questions about how the administration has discussed classified national security matters and whether anyone will be disciplined as a result of this. Senior Trump administration officials have warned in recent days that they will investigate unauthorized leaks to journalists, citing reporting in a number of publications. Several of them also for years criticized the handling of classified information by Democrats in other cases. remember, what about Hillary's emails? Trump, who did not appear to be included in the group chat, distanced himself from all, saying that the article's publication, saying after the publication, I don't know anything about it. I'm not a big fan of The Atlantic. Goldberg invoked Trump's ire during the president's first term in office when the publication reported in 2020 that he had privately disparaged U.S. service members who died in wartime. Hegseth, according to The Atlantic's report, disclosed to the group how the Yemen strike would take shape before it occurred, forcefully denied any wrongdoing, and attacked Goldberg in personal terms, calling him a deceitful journalist who peddles in garbage. And yet he was included on the group chat and reported what it is. And I should note, too, and Jay, as far as journalistic ethics go, waited a week after the actual bombing and was very careful in the information that he did tell in this article.
I thought everything he did was extraordinarily responsible, including going back and reporting this and not just jumping on it as, you know, the 24-hour news cycle tempts us to do. I mean, The Atlantic, even though they're a magazine and, you know, we think they have a more leisurely schedule than the rest of us, they do go live with everything that they do nowadays. I'm on their social media feed, and after I looked around for something other than the Washington Post to subscribe to, I immediately jumped on The Atlantic because they were just breaking stories constantly. They were having really smart takes on stuff. I thought he handled this really well, taking the time, going back, asking, A, is this true? Was I really on a national security threat? And so on and so forth.
Because he thought he was being punked, he said, right?
Right.
Jay, sure. Can I ask a question? The one, I agree with everything you said. He did a great job. And as I read the article, it's one of those articles where you know that this is a seminal article. What did you think about his decision to drop off and when he dropped off? Because if it was me, you know, I'm not a trained journalist, but I wouldn't want to drop off that, you know, that chain.
I would agree with you. My morbid curiosity would definitely keep me, and my journalistic responsibility would keep me on that. And those two have a very fine line between them. I mean, it's why we get in the business. We're curious. I think I would have stayed on for the reporting sake of it, but I probably would. A voice in the back of my head would say, there's a point at which you know what you're doing. You know you are listening in on national security secrets, and maybe you are breaking the law.
Right.
And once you are in your heart of hearts sure of
that it was real,
maybe it's time to get off. So, you know, he probably did the right thing legally. I'm not sure if I think journalistically there was an argument to stay on. Look, I didn't try to get on this thing. You dropped it in my lap. I'm reading it. You know, that's right. The kind of, you know, it's like
I've taken no action other than checking my messages.
Right.
Now, the other part of this, of course, is that Pete Hegseth, who is the Secretary of Defense, says that, look, no one was texting war plans. This was an abomination, and this guy is garbage, and so forth. And then the administration comes out and verifies the fact that this actually did take place, that this is not something that didn't happen. They said it did actually happen. So then that gets put aside. And
but don't you think that was indicative of a problem?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes, I do. How do you mean?
That it showed confusion, that they weren't coordinating with each other, that they weren't talking because they were counter-messaging.
That's right. And also, so
on something has broad implications.
The big question that seems to be looming at this hour at 9:27 on this Tuesday morning is, will anyone...
Hegseth.
Will anyone take, you know, will anyone
lose
be held responsibility or lose their job over it? Now, in early reporting last night, from what I read in the Wall Street Journal, it seemed that Donald Trump was most upset with Michael Walls. And the reason was because he was the one who set up this group chat initially. However, it is then, you know what you're on, you know for the most part, except for the reporter, you know who's on the chat. And that is, then you look at the Secretary of Defense, who is sharing the minute-to-minute war plans with the group, and the problems that, of course, that brings up. So what responsibility does he have in this? And finally, I will just say, to Jay's point about morbid curiosity, it's fascinating to see what the back and forth was.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is fascinating to see the various factions and what goes on within this administration over issues like this.
I'm going to nitpick a little bit about not what you said, but about what they did. I think that the error began before the mistake of having the journalist on. The error began when you use Signal to discuss these matters. I mean, that's the problem.
Well,
because
that's absolutely
you should
right.
absolutely never use Signal. These matters should only be discussed in a SCIF. And for those who don't know what a SCIF is, it's a private, using secure communication in a private place. And there are SCIFs everywhere these folks go. They know where the SCIF is. And often there's one traveling with them, depending on what kind of, you know, who's in the group. But any of these folks should know better than to get on public communication, because a broader question is, if Goldberg by mistake gets caught, you know, included in this, then these folks, no doubt the Chinese and the Russians are tracking as much they can these folks on a regular basis. So what else was disclosed, right? If these folks are talking about these matters on Signal, then that is beyond laxity. Gobsmacked is the word that I was researching last night, you know, because I was trying to think what's the right word for this. But I think... the problem...
egregious failure.
Right, right. Prosecutable.
Prosecutable.
But seriously, the fact that all of those people, not one of them knew better than to be on a conversation like this using Signal and using non-secure communication, that's...
Well, what I think you'll find is that there is widespread use of Signal among not just the federal government, but state governments all everywhere, city governments. And the reason why staffers use that is to avoid FOIA. They don't want to have records of their communications. And that is why they use Signal, because those are outside of FOIA and certainly illegal. But that's their motivation for doing it. The other thing is the White House press secretary tweeted out at 8:30 saying no war plans were discussed and no classified material was discussed on the thread. So if that's true and the White House press secretary says that, then if it's not classified, then they should have no problem with Jeffrey Goldberg, the journalist, then sharing the entire chat, right, with the rest of us.
So
these folks should not be people at this level should not be discussing warplanes on a non-secure mechanism of communications. I mean,
how can that not be classified? I mean, an active war plan that is going on. And they're like high-fiving each other and prayer emojis and flags and thumbs up. And how is that not classified information?
I imagine that they have a definition of a war plan, which is not what he texted. He may have sent a summary of the war plan to those folks to keep them updated. That may be their definition. But the fact that she says it's not classified, Jeffrey Goldberg is going to say, okay, if that's not classified, then you'll have no problem with me sharing the rest of the chat. Because as you said, Joe, it is watching an unscripted interaction of people at the highest levels of government debating back and forth. You know, Vice President Vance pushed back. He wanted to delay it. He said, do we need to do this? Seeing that unvarnished view, we so rarely see an off-the-record leak like this of unintentional leak of people at the highest level of government discussing something as high stakes as an attack
So I'd like to ask, presumably listening to us are some retired military folks and maybe some diplomats, foreign policy folks. I would love to hear from them about their experience and their training around communications and what you can and cannot communicate over unsecured channels. Because this is that, as you know, Senator Schumer went to the Senate floor immediately and said, you know, this is how people get killed. This is how our, you know, our the people who keep us safe get killed, because this kinds of communication happens. And what does this say to our, what does it say to our rank and file military about how they're being protected? What does this say to our allies about how their information that they share with us? This is yet another example of why our allies are going to be concerned about sharing information with us if these folks are so, I don't know, the word is, the lackadaisical doesn't even begin to cover it, but if they are so careless about how they handle classified information, and if this isn't classified, what is? I mean, you think about the boxes of documents in the bathroom and then this and so many other things. I mean, this is amateur.
Yeah, if one person had made this mistake, it would be one thing, but you've got people, the principals, as they call them, you've got the head of the CIA, you've got the director of national intelligence, you've got someone from the Treasury for reasons unknown, you've got the secretary of defense, you've got the secretary of state, you've got all these people who made all the mistakes you talked about.
And how did one of them not say, folks, let's stop this and get on?
Who is this guy, JG, on the thread? Could we have an ID on this? Well, nobody did any of this. And
but nobody said, listen, let's get on, let's shift to secure communications.
Well, the reason they didn't is because it's their standard. It's obviously their standard operating procedure that they communicate on Signal when they do not want their communications to be on email that is going to be part of the public record, that is going to be foilable when they're gone.
Or this is just a convenient thing that they do.
This is obviously not the first time that they use Signal. They use Signal because it's a secure encryption app, and there's no record of it after the chat's done.
It's not a secure encryption app to the degree that's required for people in their positions.
So
now, maybe it was okay for a Fox News reporter when Hegseth was a Fox News reporter, but certainly not as Secretary of Defense. No,
I just want to get to something that JP brought up a moment ago, that Carolyn Leavitt has commented on this. The White House on Tuesday sought to downplay the significance of a journalist being added to a group chat of administration officials discussing plans for attacks against Houthi rebels in Yemen. Carolyn Leavitt argued in a post on X that no war plans were discussed in the chat on the Signal app, echoing comments on Monday night from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. She also asserted that no classified material was sent on the thread. Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, who was included in the group chat by mistake, has said war plans were discussed. He was texting attack plans, when targets were going to be targeted, how they were going to be targeted, who was at the targets, when the next sequence of attacks was happening, Goldberg said. Leavitt, who dismissed Goldberg as well known for his sensationalist spin, also said the White House Counsel's Office has provided guidance on platforms administration officials can use to communicate. It's unclear if Signal, an app that offers encryption as well as features like disappearing messages, is an approved platform.
You know, it's really a shame that they're doing this. It goes to my point about how many people were in this room or in this chat, that if it had been one person making this mistake, they could have thrown that one person under the bus. You can't throw all these people under the bus and not have
at the highest levels. Yeah. I mean, Secretary of State, the Department of the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President of the United States,
So instead of admitting they made a mistake and saying, look, it was a mistake. Fortunately, nothing went wrong. The military operation wasn't compromised. We are going to fix whatever problems there are and do this. Instead, they're taking the Fox News approach, which was Hegseth's instinct, which was, you know, shoot the messenger and deny everything.
There's another question which they're going to have to answer, which I saw in the New York Times article, which is, was this chat conducted on their secure phones or their unsecure personal phones?
Yep.
And if it was done on their unsecured personal phones, that's going to be another, you know, another black eye for them. But what you see from this is how they operate in the government,
right.
With frequent use of Signal as their preferred method of communication, again, to avoid FOIA, to avoid record keeping laws that we have in our government at the federal level and the state level.
But I understood it was on their unsecured phones. Was I misreading that? Because that's what I understood was one of the big parts of the problem.
I don't know.
I was listening to Secretary of State's press briefing. I listened to that, and Andrea Mitchell, who, you know, she's been covering foreign policy and defense for a very, very long time, and she described it as an unprecedented breach of security.
Multiple people in stories that I've read have said that if this was a lower level person, they'd be court-martialed.
And then the other thing that Tammy Bruce, who's their spokesperson, she said, "I will not comment on a Secretary of State's deliberative remarks." So that goes counter to what the White House press said.
Right.
She describes them as deliberative remarks, said, "If you have any further questions, I suggest you ask the White House." She would not discuss it, but she described them as deliberative remarks. So that's inconsistent, it sounds like, with what, I may be wrong on that, but it sounds inconsistent with what the White House press secretary is describing them as.
Well, I don't get many of my wagers correct, but I was right on this one. We have a lot of letters.
I'm here to hear what people have to say. I hope some of them are from the military, from a military perspective.
So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to the letters and we'll continue this conversation as we talk about this text fiasco. And we'll be back right after this.
Dis-je oui, je t'aime. En m'éveillant pour être grise. Je t'aime.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. The White House pushing back at the War Plans group chat story this hour, and we're talking about it on the roundtable this morning. We do have many letters, and we get to those now. And a group, just chime in when you would like to address the thoughts from our listeners, and we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Parker writes, "This is what you get when you hire unqualified people. Maybe Doge should take a look at the cabinet members." Then Paul writes, "If Jeff Goldberg has those war plans, what is the likelihood that Vladimir and Xi also have those war plans?" Well, that's the question, right? Or
because if they did that in a situation at this high a level, are they communicating that way on a regular basis? And if no doubt, these are the kind of people who others would be tracking. They're trying to track their communication. So what else do people know about what they've been saying? That's the real question.
And have previous administrations used Signal? What was the Biden administration using Signal at all?
Kudos to John for making a really good point. Can we pause and notice the fact that we're talking about a texting platform while some of the poorest people in the Middle East are being bombed? That means murdered by the United States. Why are we doing this? That from John does put it into a context.
Thank you, John.
Then we go to Anne, who says, "This text fiasco coupled with Musk being invited to review our plans should we go to war with China kept me up last night." I think a lot of people were probably up last night.
It's a
hand raised on that one.
It's nice that she said that, because I think one of the comments from a senator was, "I don't think the American people this is keeping the American people up at night." This is before we'd actually had a night to stay up. And I'm glad to hear somebody actually did have a problem sleeping.
No, I mean, I was up till 1:32 in the morning reading about this, just trying to find. I mean, it wasn't that I was unable to sleep, but it was that I just couldn't believe. And I kept on trying to find more information about it. And there's a lot there. I mean, there isn't. It's fascinating. There's a lot of rabbit holes to go down when you start reading about it, of different things. When you start talking about secure platforms, what is, what isn't, what's protocol, what isn't protocol, then and then there's just the amusing tweet from Secretary Clinton, who says, "Are you kidding me?" Ken writes, "My question is, where was Trump? Is he even involved in running the government? Musk and Vance seem to be everywhere, involved in everything, yet 47 seems never involved. Is he simply now just the mouthpiece for his administration? It all makes me wonder if he, 47, is capable of being involved in day-to-day operations. W, Obama, and Biden were all actively involved in major operations."
What did you think about the veracity when he said in that press conference, "Oh, I'm hearing this for the first time"?
Well,
given that they probably, you know, obviously Goldberg had told them, right? Yeah. Do you believe that he was hearing that for the first time?
I don't know. I will say that within the context of the chat itself, there were several conversations in there that, in our discussions with the president, in talking with the president. So I think, to, as the letter writer point, to say that he was out of the conversation, I don't think that was the case, but wasn't in this particular
chat. No, I meant hearing about the security breach.
No, I understand. Right. I understand. But I don't know. We actually have a letter about that, and as soon as I find it, I will try to bring the two together. The outrage at this is justified. Remember her emails? But unless there are enough representatives and senators to impeach and convict, it makes no difference. Well, I mean, that's the big question, and I don't think that doesn't seem. I mean, there was a Politico article that was posted this morning that said, "Will Michael Waltz and Pete Hegseth survive the day?" And my immediate gut reaction was, yeah, of course they are. But because who's going to do anything else, especially with the because Trump was uncharacteristically quiet over the night. Maybe he slept. And now this morning, this line of reasoning is that there was no classified information and no war plans were shared.
Well, you know, to Hillary's emails bring up an interesting point here, and the question of whether it was classified or not. Sometimes things are not classified until they are classified. So they might be able to argue that nothing was classified here. Now, they went back and did a whole analysis. I think that was not Mueller, Comey went back and did a whole analysis of Clinton's emails to see if anything was classified. And they concluded that after the fact, a few things had been classified. But at the time she discussed them on her on the emails that they had available, nothing had been classified.
Nothing was more classified.
They didn't find that she violated anything along those lines. She violated a policy as opposed to giving out classified material. So
this actually, there was question about that because her predecessor had done exactly the same thing. So was it firm policy? It was as they were shifting, and there was some question about whether or not it was policy at the time.
That's right. That's right. And actually, I think he just concluded it was sloppy as opposed to illegal.
And a lot of wedding planning.
So I just want to – and this is going to sound smart alecky, and I don't mean it to be. But if you say the bomb is going to drop at this time, at this location, so that may not be classified.
Somebody didn't stamp it yet.
Right.
Yeah.
But it seems like you don't want anyone else to know, right? Right? I mean, like that.
Seems like it should be classified.
Especially the people you're
seems
going
like
to
that
drop
should be,
the bomb on.
Yeah. That would be what we would refer to as a secretive conversation.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, a plane can get shot down over the kind of information they were talking about.
Well, that's... and I was struck by the number you alluded to this, and as did Teresa, about the number of military officials who said, had I done this?
That's why I want to hear from military.
I'd be gone. Well, here you go. Erica. "This vet is disgusted," writes Erica. "Besides the negligence, the complete lack of seriousness, throughout the chain is something to behold. It looks like a chain between my daughter's soccer team. Seriously, emojis? Is this some kind of Monty Python skit? You're bombing people in another country and undoubtedly killing some innocent civilians as collateral damage. There is no such bomb that neatly kills only the intended target. Oh, but wait. Remember the JAGs they fired? Over the next 4 years, as military operations are investigated, this administration is going to get away with literal murder. You see how enthusiastic they are applying cruelty to American citizens. How many times has Trump butt-dialed Putin? I shudder to imagine that from Erica. Then we go to Mark. The word is reckless. The president is reckless. All of his supporters are reckless. All of his appointees are reckless. Everyone who voted for him, he rewards bad behavior. The voters rewarded his bad behavior. No surprises here, writes Mark. Off to Suzanne. The reason the Treasury Secretary was in on the chat is because none of these people are in government for their competency at their respective roles, but because they are part of their little club of mean, angry boys on a collective power trip. Then we go to Amy. This breach just shows the ego in Trump's cabinet. That's why none of them knew to take in this classified conversation off the thread. They think they're invincible. America's not safe with this kind of behavior. Trump and his cabinet showed carelessness with intelligence and classified information on top of the utter disrespect for our allies. They're laying out our private and classified information like a buffet spread for our adversaries. In my opinion, unforgivable. Then we go to Florian. My therapist often asks me to consider what is troubling me in terms of process versus content. Right now, we are rightly going after Waltz, Hegseth, Vance, and company on process and all the problems with it. Again, rightly so. But can we also consider the significance of the content, not just whether it is a war plan or classified, quote unquote? They were glibly talking about killing people without any urgency except for Trump's preference.
Yeah, the lack of urgency is really interesting here. That it was, I believe, Vance who said, hey, you know, maybe we could wait a month. And what was also really interesting was, I'm not sure the president realizes how inconsistent this is with his message on Europe,
yeah,
or on the Middle East.
That was a line that
it was a great
Vance
line.
Vance, yeah. Right. Vance.
But the lack of urgency when you think when somebody on this call says, you know, we could wait a month, couldn't we, to get better messaging on this and to kind of set the public up for an understanding of who the Houthis are, because nobody really knows who the Houthis are, and we also need, and they were also talking about, we need to make this about Biden. And we need to make, there were two points. And that's all it boiled down to for them was blame the existing situation on Biden and we fixed it. And that's what all this was about.
It was about messaging and politics,
yeah.
Not about what you might think.
Clearing up
strategic,
the red
sea.
I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised the number of times that Biden's name was brought up and by Stephen Miller, by Vance. And simply because I just thought that was a lot of stuff that they put out in front of the people and it's, you know, dog and pony show. But that this is really the guiding force of how they really feel, I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what I was going to say carries on that, because when Hegseth got off the plane and went to the mics to respond to this, he did the two reflexive things that they do. He denigrated the press and he denigrated former President Biden, and you know that this, we have to do this because he did not, and he wasn't, you know, people, we should be able to travel safely through this area and we can't because of Biden, and so, you know, we're showing how it's supposed to work, kind of tough talk. And and the interesting thing would be like who actually, I think John was an earlier writer in his previous asks a very important question: was it strategically necessary? Who did get killed? And what were the implications for innocent citizens?
The other thing that was on the thread that was fascinating to that point was, We don't want the Israelis to do it first, and we don't want the Europeans to do it first. We want to do it first so it's on our terms. I don't even know what that means exactly, other than we want to do it our way and we want the credit for it.
Deb writes, as alluded to this conversation, all governmental communications have to be on the record, even if classified, redacted, or embargoed. It's part of our nation's history. There is a Federal Records Act, and they all violated it.
But now they control the archives, so who knows?
Diane writes, of all the things that I hate about... Oh, can I just get to a point real quick? Talk about the archives, but there is a book called Who is Government? The Untold Story of Public Service. Michael Lewis, who's best known for Moneyball and some other incredible books, is the Blind Side, The Big Short, and Going Infinite. He has put this book together called Who is Government? The Untold Story of Public Service. And he went out to great writers like Dave Eggers and John Lanchester and Geraldine Brooks, and ask them to find someone who works in public service and to describe what they do. Sarah Vowell, who is no stranger to NPR Airwaves, is going to be with us at 10:45 this morning to talk about her particular entry in this volume, which is about a person who works in the archives.
Really?
The US
Ooh,
archives.
That's terrific.
It's fascinating. It really is. So we'll sort of stay on that track a little bit later on when Sarah Val joins us.
It's so good that they're doing that. I didn't know about this book, but we really need a better understanding of what people who work in the government do.
Yeah.
Ask
if there's a ladder that they roll to get things
off
high places.
Top shelf.
It's all, when I hear archives, that's all I think of. It's like a definite image, and it's probably just
a
computer
screen. I mean, I will tell you, in having been to many, many presidential archives, they do. They have the ladders that go right around the rooms, and most of them, which is fascinating.
I want a library with one of those. Ladders.
Isn't
like
that cool?
Ladders. I love
ladders. Okay. I mean, they're dangerous, and I'd probably fall off of it, but still. Yes, go ahead.
Well, this is off topic, but on topic with archives. I couldn't figure out why the Trump administration was immediately so fixated on taking over the archives, driving everybody out at the upper echelons. And what I discovered, which I did not know, is that the archives, they oversee the Electoral College.
Janet writes, could you please discuss the quote-unquote coincidence that the only non-government participant on the text happened to be the editor of The Atlantic? Well, we don't know. I think that the best description was that somebody put in two letters and it came. Were you saying this earlier, JP, that it came up? You start putting
just
in
my hypothesis.
It was a hypothesis.
Yeah.
Okay.
The way the Signal phone book works.
Yes. So you would put in. So, for example, if I am emailing JP and I just put JP in to the two column, it just self populates in JP Miller. And sometimes John Parrish also will come up, and I'm like, well, that's not who I'm sending it to, but I check it. And sometimes if I do, it's just like my dental appointment.
And wouldn't you think that if there was somebody else that was they were supposed to be putting in, that they would note that person?
I think
there's so many levels of just being crazy.
I think Janet makes a really good point, though, in that the only non-government participant, and that's what we're being told. I mean, I don't know for sure. I don't know where the list is and if Goldberg has that as to who else would have been a part of it or have had access to it.
And Goldberg reported it really well. He said he described it in his article as SM, who I assume to be Stephen Miller. And so I think it's possible that Goldberg, while he has assumptions on all those people that were on the chain that are, I would say, right, that he doesn't know for sure who these different participants are.
Diane says, of all the things I hate about Trump and his administration, it's his complete disregard for protecting our national secrets. The Mar-a-Lago bathroom repository should have put him away for a wife. Republicans used to be at least say that national security was their concern, but we're not going to hear much from them on this. Oh, I think you're going to hear plenty, but it's just will be hypocritical.
I think the White House's response today has put Congress in the Republicans in Congress in a really interesting position. Yesterday, a lot of them were saying, "I'm going to withhold judgment until we get all the details on this," which implied that they are going to get all the details on this. And people were saying this is serious on its face. We need to look at it. Now the White House is just saying, "Nope, nothing to see here. That's it." And
but there's a hearing today. He's under oath of the National Security Advisor, right? There's a hearing which was
scheduled prior
in
to
advance.
This.
Right.
Yes.
But it's like Social Security hearing.
He's in Greenland, isn't he?
Who?
The National Security Advisor?
Oh, I don't know.
I think there was a national threats hearing today, right?
Yes, that is true.
It was prior scheduled for today, a hearing on a regular review of the national threats. And there is scheduled testimony, and it'll be interesting to hear what they have to say, it'll be interesting to hear what the Social Security testimony is today.
We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Use our secure server at wamc.org, panel.
You got to set up a signal inbox. Come on, Joe.
wamc.org. We'll be back right after this.
René le printemps.
Okay, a couple of letters on the text leak, and we will then move on to other topics. We go to Maryland by using Maryland, the name, not the state, Maryland. By using Signal, they were attempting to avoid having any official record of their actions. That begs the question about how often this administration operates like this. Then Signal erases communication in 30 days, which avoids a permanent record, which is against law of recording all executive communications, according to Howard.
But it does stay on their phones for a period of time within that. So that means, and it goes to the question of were they unsecured phones or secure phones, that in the time that they are walking around, anybody could be looking at
listening
their phones.
To them.
Well, this is also the problem with Signal. You know, people have invited me to be on Signal. And what I say is, whatever you want to text me on Signal, I don't want to know, right? And if it's on Signal, even if it is encrypted and even if it is being deleted, people can screenshot their phones or take a picture of their phones. And there is then a permanent record of it, which is exactly what this journalist did. So Signal kind of gives users a false sense of, oh, we're on an encrypted forum here. We can send around heart emojis and American flag emojis when the bombs drop. And we can kind of let our hair down because we're on this encrypted platform. But there can be pictures, there can be screenshots, and there is now a permanent record thanks to the journalist being added to the chat.
It's like that Onion headline, man foils FBI by using, private window on browser. You know, it's not true.
Right.
So, anyway.
Russ writes, I guarantee you that as the dust settles on this quote-unquote leak scandal, the one holding the bag will be Jeff Goldberg, who likely will be prosecuted for having been included in the note chain.
How can he be prosecuted?
Well, I know, but
is that sarcastic
it's
or is
not,
he meaning that? I mean, I do think they'll try to turn on him, but because Trump doesn't like him to begin with. But
I'm sure that Goldberg has already taken steps toward this end, but I'm sure they're going to try to get his phone and find out. You know, it's going to be a fishing expedition. You know, who does he talk to?
Literally, because hopefully he just like threw it in the East River.
Ah.
MJ says, I thought the commander-in-chief only hired the brightest and best, and these heads of companies, millionaires, and former government workers don't know the rules for top-secret communications as required by the federal government. They are amateurs. Fire all of them. Then Jeff says, does anyone find it interesting that this happened over a week ago, and when Trump was asked about it yesterday, he claimed it was the first he heard about it? Seriously, if you're getting security briefings from the media 9 days after an event, well, I believe those were the sounds that were made in the letters that were put together.
You did a great job, Joe.
Yes, yeah.
Well, that was my point earlier, is that he claimed to not know, so he either knew and he wasn't telling the truth, or he should have known, or he was told and he didn't remember. I don't know, but
no matter which, it wasn't a good look.
No. I mean, I don't know one way or the other, but I will say that certainly there is a pattern where the president, in responding to such things, says, this is the first I'm hearing of this, only to find out that it has been a major...
I never met them. I don't know who they are.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who they are.
These are his go-to responses whenever he is a grown, I would say around a 9-year-old, who is just constantly being caught in a lie or caught getting in trouble, and his go-to response is, I didn't do it.
I have no idea who that is, sir. Her name is Tiffany.
I know nothing about Project 2025. I've never read it.
That's right.
I know nothing about it. Of course, my entire operation is now being run by people who are running that. But I think the question here is, why does this matter? What are the implications for our national security? What are the risks for those who are serving us in the military? What are the risks for those who are serving us in the intelligence collection community? What are the risks for people in the diplomatic community? And then what are the risks for our allies?
So this is what worries me, Teresa, and I want to move on to other things, but I'll just say that this is somewhat off the cuff, but the fact that it seems that the answers to all of your questions to me, and I think to most of us in this room, are obvious. Why they're not obvious to most other people is what is daunting to me of trying to figure out, hence the up till 2 a.m. trying to read as much as I can. It just seems that if you're giving out war plans, call it whatever you want, the bombs are going to drop now. That seems to be really important information that most people shouldn't have access to. Right. And so you're absolutely right. All those questions are right on. But I mean, I think we know the answers, but why everyone isn't on that same page is beyond me.
And if you're doing this so casually, I'll call it casually or matter-of-factly, then what else are they doing?
Well,
is
all
this the
stuff
pattern
that's
in practice, right? And then if this is the pattern in practice, then for the last 40 days or 38 or however many days it's been, who's been listening? Because if they're this casual and not careful, then other people are listening. And what are the implications for the negotiations around Ukraine? What are the implications for the discussions with China? What are the implications for the discussion with Russia? If the people at the highest levels of our national security and intelligence groups are acting this way on something as important as a military operation, then what is this their standard mode of operation?
But yes, right?
Yes.
So even what's being done in public, out in the open, of the dismantling of the Education Department, or firing 1,000 workers at a time, we'll talk about it. But what's happening with Social Security, or what's happening with the IRS? I mean, that is as random and as slapshot as any of this, right? I mean, it's part of
right.
The...
Well, I repeat myself on this all the time, but allowing the outside groups to go in and look at our Social Security information, Treasury information, IRS information, people who perhaps they have, but there's been no indication so far that they've had background checks. There's been no indication that they've signed contracts, that they have non-disclosure agreements, that there are limitations put on how they can use this data or how they can. I mean, it's as if there's a major security break, right?
Well, it was this other the other day, this idea that Elon Musk was supposedly going to get a briefing on China,
right?
And we have no real proof that he didn't. All we have is a president who denied that he was even ever going to get it, which is absurd. I mean,
He said it was DOGE related to the question being, then why were you at the Pentagon?
Well, don't you have to presume that there's some generals or higher-ups who were horrified at that and made sure that it got public so it got stopped? But I don't know.
Get on the signal chain and we'll figure this out, will you?
I can't even follow a signal chain when people are making plans for dinner. I don't know. I mean, I just like, okay, who's on first here? And like, this is, and they're planning a war. And then the reflexive thing to do when they get in trouble, blame the media, denigrate the media, and blame the Biden administration. Yep. How long are they going to buy that train?
To your question, I think you got half of America, when they first read the story, before they had any impression of it whatsoever, wanted to know, why does this matter? And the other half of America wanted to know, why doesn't it matter? Because I really don't want it to matter because I love this president. And the other half of America forgot how to do math. So
that's three halves.
That's three halves.
That's right.
My dad was a math teacher.
Unfortunately, Trump knows this better than anything. Than anything he knows is that if they can just make this an issue about the issue and not about
the
substance,
the issue,
the substance of it, then it goes away because he'll come up with a new outrage pretty soon.
There will be another outrage tomorrow.
Yep.
Or this afternoon.
By the end of the day.
I'm sure today he'll be.
Usha
Vance, what should be the outrage today is the discussion about Social Security.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to do that right now.
Oh,
let's
good.
Do it.
Okay. So this is we want to talk about Social Security and what is going on there as we move on. We welcome your letters on this topic as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. When the Wall Street veteran Frank Bisignano goes before Congress on Tuesday as President Trump's pick to lead the Social Security Administration, he will confront questions about how he would run an agency suddenly in the grips of upheaval. In recent weeks, the billionaire Elon Musk has zeroed in on the agency, which is charged with the staid but critical work of providing retirement, survivor, and disability payments to 73 million Americans each month. This from the New York Times. Mr. Musk has claimed that vast numbers of Americans are fraudulently drawing benefits from the agency, an assertion experts say is demonstrably false. Over the objections of longtime career civil servants pushed out of the agency, the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency has moved swiftly to scrutinize its internal databases, deploying at least 10 staff members inside, including a longtime confidant of Mr. Musk. At the same time, the acting commissioner, Leland Dudick, a former mid-level manager, has made a number of head-spinning moves. On Friday, he threatened to shut down the system used for all of the Social Security Administration's work in response to a judge's order, only to back down hours later. The churn has alarmed many older and disabled Americans who rely on Social Security payments and worry it could become harder to gain access to them. It's a lot of confusion, frankly, a lot of chaos, said Bill Sweeney, the vice president of governmental affairs at AARP, which represents older Americans. People are terrified of what's happening with Social Security. There's a level of anxiety about this among our members that Congress, policymakers, and the administration need to take seriously. Meanwhile, some Democratic lawmakers say they are so concerned that the Trump administration is setting the agency up to fail that they sent a letter on Sunday asking for Mr. Bisignano to promise not to privatize any of its components, saying that they are gravely concerned in the letter written by Senator Elizabeth Warren and Ron Wyden of Oregon. Teresa.
Well, I think that we do need to be very, very concerned about how they are handling Social Security. I do not know why Musk and his folks have access to our Social Security information. And I think there needs to be more awareness, more light shown on what they are doing with it, because there are some groups have long talked about wanting to privatize Social Security, and certainly some of their big money donors would benefit economically from that. But I think that the comment the other day by the Commerce Secretary really encapsulated the stark issue here, where he talked about his mother-in-law, who's in her 90s, and said that, well, you know, if she didn't get her check 1 month, she'd certainly understand and wait for it to come the next month, and only, quote-unquote, fraudsters would be opposed. And that shows a deep lack, either lack of concern or complete misunderstanding about what Social Security means to people. Can you imagine? And again, I would love to hear from people who are on Social Security who, for them, these checks really matter, because those checks get, in many cases, get directly deposited, and presumably there are also payments that are then directly made off of those checks. So if what happens when a check doesn't get directly deposited and then the automatic payments are made and there's nothing to be drawn down? What happens to that person? And what happens when that person, if they have any questions or concerns, needs to go in person to an office now because now they are shutting down offices and they are reducing the number of people? And you're talking about vulnerable elderly people here. And I just think that if we are not deeply concerned and outraged about this, and our Republican members of Congress are not deeply concerned about this, when what are they going to be concerned about?
JP.
Frank Bisignano, before going to Fiserv, he was a longtime lieutenant of JP Morgan of Jamie Dimon's at JP Morgan. And I am hopeful that he... figures out a way to get our Social Security Trust Fund in order. Our Social Security Trust Fund is currently $2.7 trillion. It's set to go bankrupt in 2035. And back when I started paying attention to this in 1999, when I was a senior in high school, 2035 seems like so far in the future. You know, it's 35 years from now. Who cares? But now it's 2025. And so the Social Security Trust Fund is scheduled to go bankrupt in just 10 years. And as us older people all know, 10 years now goes by pretty fast, right? So the big thing with Social Security Trust Fund is it only invests in one asset, and that's U.S. Treasury bills, which is a poor yielding asset. You know, right now Treasury bills get about 4%. And so over those, you know, since 1999, had the Social Security Trust Fund been invested in other assets other than Treasury bills, the Social Security Trust Fund would be worth two or three times what it is today. And it wouldn't be going bankrupt in 2035. It would be going scheduled to go bankrupt in 2050 or 2075 or 2100. So we need to figure out a way to get more money in the Social Security Trust Fund so that it doesn't go bankrupt in 2035. And I hope Frank Bisignano, who is a, you know, whether you agree with his politics or not, he's a very smart financial person who's been on Wall Street for 30 years.
But does he want to privatize it or not?
When you say, what do you mean by privatize? What do you mean by privatize?
Not have it be a federal program.
Well, it's by definition, it's a federal program.
Right. But some people believe that it shouldn't be.
I think there's debate as to whether it should invest in assets other than Treasury bills, and my view is that it should invest in assets other than Treasury bills.
That's one of the debates. There's a whole bunch of ways that have been looked at to shore up Social Security, whether you raise the income limits on contributions, start changing around with the age, which I don't think is a really great idea, given how fast arthritis hit me, at 65. And I don't know that I want one person off Wall Street figuring this out. That's the thing, is that this is just, I feel like they're just punting at this point. You know, that 10 years is going to go by fast. And that number keeps changing depending on what the market's doing, because the market affects the Treasury bills, and that number has moved backwards by 2 years since the last time I had been paying attention to it. And to Teresa's point, it's the system is, if there's anything I'm losing sleep over, it's that.
Right.
It's that one day, one at the end of the month, I'm going to see there's been no transfer on the check. And that pays the bills. That helps pay the bills. And that's a serious matter. Now, we have a buffer. Most, you know, a lot of people don't.
Right.
And the
Commerce Secretary's comment suggested a lack of either awareness or concern that a lot of people don't. And calling people fraudsters if they're upset, I mean, that to me was just reprehensible.
Yeah. This is, to relate it to the last discussion we were having on national security and Trump hiring the best people, it's as if he just was in a bar and just looked around and said, yeah, you'd be a good fill in the blank for a title and you'd be a good fill in the blank for that title. And everybody just came in without any expertise. And then you have Elon Musk gutting the people who actually do have.
Well, that's the problem. And I have no knowledge of the person who he's nominated. I'm more concerned about the people who have been in there already, and working through that data and what they are doing, and do they have rights to have access to it? Are they changing the system at all in ways that we don't know? That's what concerns me. And also it concerns me that, this is a media problem I have as well, is Trump keeps saying, oh, I'm not going to let anyone cut Social Security. And the reporters don't say, well, you already have. You've already laid off a bunch of people. You're already closing down offices, right? So every time he says, on one of the Sunday shows, it happened again where he said, the reporter said, well, but, you know, Trump has vowed not to touch Social Security. But, and then they name things that his administration has already done as if that's not him.
But that's, I don't like to try to interpret Trump often, but Trump, I'm sure, means I am not going to cut people's benefits. But when you create all these other problems in the system,
when you lay people off,
you are effectively doing that.
And so right. that you don't have easy access to it, and when you close offices so you don't have access to it, when you can't get problems fixed because it's and when you have to go in person, when you have people who are in some cases not able.
I just want to we're up against a break, but I just want to say to your point, Teresa, which I think is a really good one. I mean, we're already seeing it. We're already impacted.
He's already doing it.
I mean, people who are, I have a family member who's, you know, had an appointment on April 2nd to work out on their benefits, and that appointment now has been canceled, and said that there's nothing available after March 30th. And go to your local Social Security office, which is either closed or has limited hours, and so. I mean, all of that is really that's happening right now, and what is the next step then? What happens next after that? Are we just in a period of transition, or is what we see what we get? And I don't know the answer to that. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll finish up our time together on this Tuesday morning, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We welcome you as always. First, this break and news.
Fleur de nuit, fleur d'ennui.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. J.P. Miller, Jay Jochnowitz, and Teresa Bourgeois with us making up the panel. We just have about 10 minutes or so. And then joining us at 10:45 is Sarah Vowell, who's a contributor to the new Michael Lewis book, Who is Government? The Untold Story of Public Service. And Sarah will join us then. In the meantime, let's talk about Columbia. And I mean Columbia University. The fallout from Columbia capitulation fuels fears about academic freedom. University administrators across the nation are warning that Columbia University's compliance with the Trump administration's demand for sweeping policy changes, with $400 million in federal funding on the line, may have a chilling effect on academic independence. There are enormous fears among universities all across the country as to what's going to come, according to the dean of the law school at the University of California at Berkeley. I think it just emboldens the Trump administration to go after more universities in the exact same way. When external pressures dictate campus policy or institutional direction, it risks undermining both academic freedom and free speech, according to Mary Papazan, Executive Vice President of the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. The outcry comes from an announcement Friday that Columbia will institute new rules on student protests and discipline, bring in new campus police officers with arrest powers, and begin an overhaul of the university's Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies Department. Those changes dovetail with recent demands by Trump administration officials who declared in early March that they plan to cancel $400 million in federal funds and grants because of what they described as the university's failure to protect Jewish students after protest over the Israel-Gaza war that rocked the campus last year.
If all this had been about securing, making sure that the campus had proper security, I wouldn't have as big a problem with it. I don't like the idea that they're bullying them at all. It does sound like I'm not on the campus, so I don't know what it's like. But it sounded as if there were Jewish students who felt that they were not protected and that they felt threatened. Okay, if you want to create a safer environment and Columbia wasn't doing it, and it took the federal government to come in and say, "Hey, you got to do a better job," I wouldn't have had a problem with it. But they're going into curriculum who's hiring and who's being hired in departments and stuff. This is a terrible intrusion into higher education by the government.
Please do not confuse what I'm saying. I'm not saying that this is extortion, but it seems like extortion.
Oh, I think it's extortion.
I mean, right? I mean, it just seems like you do what we say.
Yeah.
Or we're going to take away $400 million.
Nice little campus you got here. Be ashamed if anything happened to it.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely extortion. And it feels like, and what bothers me even more about this or adds to the bother about it is the capitulation of the Paul Weiss law firm. And this goes back to the fact that Trump is used to using, he's getting used to using power in very bad ways. It was bad enough
that he
intimidated people in his own party. He made Ted Cruz kissed the ring. He made Marco Rubio kiss the ring. Even Vance, who once said, you know, he's like an American Hitler, he's now his vice president. That was bad enough. But one by one by one, he's finding ways to use his power or the money that the federal government controls to intimidate people. This is not a good direction for the country, not just higher ed.
Teresa or JP mm-hmm. and then Teresa.
Oh, what I found interesting was there were protests yesterday by a lot of the faculty wearing masks. And one of the big things is they don't want people to wear masks while they're protesting. It's something that Governor Hochul is trying to pass at the state level, which is they don't want protesters wearing masks because they feel like they're hiding their identity so that they can commit anti-Semitic acts. I look at the president of Columbia as one of the most difficult, challenging jobs right now, because there is the question of, it's an open question, what is anti-Semitism and what isn't anti-Semitism in terms of these protests and what these kids are doing. You also look at the different constituencies the Columbia president has, which is the federal government, the state government, parents, students, professors, and most of all for them, wealthy alumni who basically fund the school. And navigating those constituencies and making those decisions is really tough. And I did look up some stats in preparation. They admit every year they have 1,500 full-time freshmen get into Columbia. It's a very small number of kids that get to go. 60,000 kids apply every year, and they let 1,500 in. A lot of them athletes, a lot of them children of wealthy alumni. The tuition and board, $93,000 a year to go to Columbia. That's a real number. And their endowment is currently at $14.8 billion. So that the Columbia president makes $3 or $4 million a year. So that Columbia president has a lot of constituencies to deal with at a very unenviable job.
So I think Jay was exactly right about the what the core fundamental issue here is: the use of power by this administration, or some might say the abuse of power, but certainly the irregular use of power. And use of power against law firms, use of power against targeted universities, this use of power against the media or different corporations. And I think it's something that we need to be deeply, deeply, you know, questioning and I would say concerned about. But for the universities, you know, you saw this coming. You saw what Congresswoman Elise Stefanik did with some glee in terms of trying to drive out, and in some cases successfully, university leaders. One has to question, I mean, you go to Project 2025 or the America First Agenda and you see this there, but why these attacks on universities? Why these economic and verbal attacks on universities, and what's the point? But I would have hoped that a group of these universities would have come together and collectively pushed back in support of Columbia against this, because Columbia is the first, but they will not be the last. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, on the part of Trump and his team is performative for a purpose. And it's just a bad, dangerous road to go down, because where does it stop? And you know, this is not typical behavior of a president or of an administration. And I think at what point does it stop? JD, if you point appropriately to their endowment, to Columbia's endowment, well, could they absorb this cut, this $400 million cut? But I think more importantly, could they not force a conversation, because it's not just this university, it's so many that are being affected by these threatened cuts or real cuts or freezing of their funds. What are these dollars used for? And aren't they in most cases used for the betterment of our country? And what do we lose if we cut this research, to get the message out about what is this research? What is the government putting at risk? And does it matter in our lives? And they're playing politics with our future and our future health care, or probably, I'm guessing some of this is chips, and, you know, there's all sorts of innovations and research that you get with these dollars, whether it's Columbia or other places that are threatened with these dollars. I think we need to have a conversation about, well, what is the Trump administration putting at risk when they attack these universities in this way, using these financial cudgels?
I think performative is a good word for this, because I looked up the definition of, I'm not absolutely positive on this, but from what I understand, they took so one of the things the Trump administration wanted them to do was to redefine anti-Semitism, so that they had an administration approved definition of it going forward.
Okay, I'm sorry, I got to stop you for a moment.
Yep.
By the person who, when people were in Charlottesville, Virginia, and they were marching through the streets where some of my friends live, mm-hmm. and they were carrying tiki torches and chanting, "The Jews will not replace us." This is the person who's cracking down? Sorry to interrupt you, but we just need some context here. We need some context.
Absolutely fair. The definition that they went with, apparently, is a definition that was done by created by a task force in 2024 on anti-Semitism on campus. And it is not the definition, the broader definition that's being used. It's a much more expansive definition. It's a less expansive definition. So it doesn't get into the idea of criticizing Israel as inherently anti-Semitic, which I think is what the administration really wanted. They didn't want any criticism of that.
We are going to have to end there. My thanks to everyone for a vibrant conversation, as always. I so appreciate it. Again, tomorrow's panel will be live from the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff. And we hope you'll listen to us tomorrow from 9 to 11. J.P. Miller, Jay Jochnowitz, and Teresa Bourgeois, you're all wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll sort of stay on the same topic here and talk about Who is Government? The Untold Story of Public Service. It's a new book edited by Michael Lewis. We'll talk to one of the contributors, the great Sarah Vowell, coming up next.